Good evening, very well welcome to the Emmanuel Meeting House. It's great to see you here for an event that has come around quicker than we expected. We didn't release in 2010, we didn't release in 2015. We did a sort of own, Brexit version. We didn't know that there was going to be a Brexit then. At this time, sort of last year, and here we are with another general election. Some of us are very excited about staying up all night a week's time, others of us just here because we're depressed about the whole thing on some kind of happy vote. Hopefully, wherever we are, we're excited or mystified. Tonight is going to be a couple of days as we seek to think Christianly about how we interact with the general election that's happening all around us. I'm going to ask God to help and pray to start and then sort of check what we're doing as a prayer. Father God, we thank you that you are the Lord, all creator of the universe. We thank you that you hold everything in your hands, including general elections in the UK. We do pray for your help now as we consider how we should be responding to what's going on around us, how we should be voting as Christians in this country today. Give us wisdom and insight, we pray. In Jesus' name. Amen. You should all have one of these, which is either a handout or a fan, or both. On here is what we're going to do this evening. We're going to start by a little bit of looking back at the last election, 2015, and the latest polls in this election. The polls are being very exciting, particularly over the last week or so. We've been thinking Christianly about voting, and quite a lot of information on a rather mega table that goes over a little couple of pages. Before we turn to think about Christian agendas and party manifestos, focus on Brexit, candidate profiles, and then very much over to you for Q&A and discussion. Your dream team this evening is myself, Judy Rivers, and Katie Torrey. We are the team that brought you the Euro referendum last year, we're very pleased to bring you a general election this year to what we'll bring you next year. Is any of these guests? I'm going to hand over to Judy.
Some people are hoping that next year will bring you the next Brexit referendum. What I want to start doing is just for those who haven't been watching the polls, just to update and get you up to speed with what the opinion polls have been telling us about the likely outcome of the election this week. The little chart you can see there is the result of the election 2015. You'll see the Conservatives polled 36.9% of the vote, which gave them a bare majority, 330 out of 650 seats in the House of Commons, technically a majority of 10, actually a working majority of 17 for the various technical reasons. Labour a bit behind at 30.4, getting 220 odd seats, and then UKIP massive pre-Brexit vote for UKIP on 12.7%. Lib Dems were of course annihilated as a result of the cost of going into coalition with the junior party with the Conservatives. They got only 7.9%, and that's about half of the vote from, it's a third of the vote from 5 years before, and so on down the others. Now what's been going on is when the election was called, Theresa May had the most phenomenal ratings in the polls, so she was polling about 50%, which as a turnout in an election would have been unprecedented since the 1950s for the Conservative Party. And ever since then, the Conservative vote has been dropping and dropping and dropping and dropping and dropping, and the Labour vote has been rising and rising and rising and rising and rising. So where we're at today, if you look at the polls over the last couple of weeks, is that the Conservatives are on about 43%, which you can see is an increase, quite a substantial increase from 2015. Labour are on about 34 to 35%, again an increase. UKIP has been severely damaged by having won the Brexit vote. They're polling about 4%, so about a third of what they polled at the last election. Lib Dems are not recovering. They're hovering pretty much at 7.9 or 8%. Tim Farron has yet to make an impact on the population at large. And the Greens also are suffering, so they are tending to go down. They were on 3.8% back in 2015, now about 2 to 3% at the moment. In other words, what we're seeing is a return of two-party politics. That's quite unusual. We've been used to having more parties in play. But between them, Conservative and Labour are picking up about 80% of the vote. We haven't seen that for a long time. What we don't know, of course, is what's going to happen in next week. And there are a number of things one can say about the opinion polls. At the moment, the projections are still for a Conservative majority, a majority of probably about 80 seats in House of Commons, a comfortable majority, a big increase on what Theresa May currently has. But, of course, the direction of travel has been not in her favour, very much in Jeremy Corbyn's favour, so we don't know where that will land in a week's time. A couple of things you might like to bear in mind. One is that the voting profile for Conservative and Labour no longer falls along class, socioeconomic class boundaries. If you look at the profiles, they're almost identical. So the same type of class of person is split across both Labour and Conservative. Instead, what has happened is an age split, a very, very marked age split. So young people up to 25 overwhelmingly vote Labour, people between 25 and 45 mostly Labour, although there's a certain representation of Conservative, 45 to 65 substantially Conservative, 65 and above almost entirely Conservative. So the country is split on an age basis, not a socioeconomic class basis. Now we know that young people tend not to bother to vote. And Jeremy Corbyn is obviously hoping that he can mobilise the young vote, because if he does get out and vote, his chances are a lot higher. The reason polling organisations struggle to tell us what the outcome will be is because they cannot predict turnout. Turnout is very variable. The other variable factor is to do with the number of floating voters. Until about a generation ago, people reckoned that about 15% of the population floated. So you had 85% who were die-hard voters one side or the other, and the 15% who went from side to side and determined which of the two main parties got in power. It seems as if the floating vote is now about 45%. It's enormous. And because the floating vote is so big, it can change very rapidly, it can be very volatile. So we might, in a week's time, see Theresa May have recovered all the lost ground and an overwhelming Conservative victory. On the other hand, we might see Conservative meltdown, and you might see Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister. Both options are entirely possible, and I think we should just bear that in mind as we think about how we vote. I don't see anything else by way of introduction of getting this going this evening. I want to keep people's meetings so we've got plenty of time for discussion. But are there any questions just about the data or the figures? In which case, let's move on to the next section.
Which is me, and thinking Christianly about voting. And the first question we might want to sort of ask ourselves is, why want to vote at all as a Christian? Why should we be engaged in the political process in the UK? We've done quite a lot of this in previous events. We're going to do this relatively shortly now. And I'm going to do it by taking you back, as you can see on those handouts, right at the beginning of the Bible and to Genesis chapter 1. If you are thinking to yourself on next Thursday, I cannot be bothered. Why should I make time to go to the polling station all the way to work all the way back from work? Or why should I bother to take my postal ballot out of the car? Think to yourself, God has given me this job. You might think, where's that from? Well, look down at Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. We know that we're right at the beginning of history. The Creator God has given us as human beings, created in His image, the job of ruling over this planet. Genesis 1 verse 26, then God said, let us make mankind, humankind, in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea, and the birds in the sky, over livestock, and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. One of the great privileges of being a human being, created in God's image, is being given the job of being a vice-regent in His stead over this planet, ruling it responsibly and carefully for His glory. And one of the ways that we do that in the UK is that we elect representatives to do that job for us. You'll be pleased to know that Ed Shaw is not responsible for any area of government. Instead, in our system, I and you have been given a vote in which we elect a representative to do that job for us. As it were, to help rule over this part of the world that God has created. And if you want motivation to go to the polling station, to put on a cross on the box, remember, it's a job that God has given to humanity. It's something that we're asked to do by Him, to take responsibility for the ruling of the planet that He's given us. Dave Landrum is the head of public policy at the Evangelical Alliance, and I love his little phrase that he puts, that he was quoted on in a book produced for the last lecture, that government is the family business of God. God rules over all. He's put human beings in as his vice-regents, and he's involved us in this job of order, of responsibly running this planet in a way that brings glory to him and is for the good of this planet and the people of it. And as we've got that cross on the box, we're doing something that God has called us to do. God has made us a fulfilling responsibility that God has given us as his image bearers. So why should we vote as Christians? Genesis chapter 1, you don't need to read any further in your Bible than the first page. How should we vote as Christians? Slightly more complicated. You can read from your Bible, you can start reading the Bible, Genesis chapter 1 to 9, and read through to Revelation, and at no point are you going to get the vote that tells the verse that tells us to vote conservative or to vote neutral, or to vote dead, or to vote green, or to vote. Sadly, I think. How should we vote? What are the things we should be thinking about as Christians, as it were, to help us terminate on vote? One of the good things about election time is that loads of people give us advice, and the world around us, but also amongst the Christian community. And that's why we've got this massive table in front of you now, so that you can collate or have collated in one place all the bits of advice that various Christian organisations are giving people like us on what we should be voting on what basis we should be voting, what are the issues that we should be caring about because we are Christians, what are the questions we should be asking candidates, either in person if they turn up on our door or our husband. Or as we read the party manifestos, what are the particular things we should be looking for in those texts of promises. And there's a whole host of organisations that have put out advice, including the Anglican Archbishops of Canterbury and York, have done a pastoral letter, they do have resolved it. CARE, one of the Christian lobbying organisations of Westminster, has produced something. The Catholic bishops have produced a very long pastoral note with a whole series of things that you can see over the page. That's our Christian Concern and Christian Institute and the Evangelical Alliance. All, as it were, coming up with help for you and me, saying that as Christians, this is what we think we should be caring about. These are the questions we should be asking. As you said, skim read that, you'll notice quite a lot of overlap, which is encouraging, isn't it? That these guys are all reading the same Bible and coming up with roughly the same sort of things that we should be thinking about. You'll see some old issues we're used to seeing. Issues we're used to caring about as Christians. But I think I just want to point out two new issues for us that perhaps are coming to a greater prominence from Christian organisations. One is the freedom issue. Going back 20 years or so, I don't think you have seen such a concern from Christian organisations about religious freedom, both in the wider world around us, but also within the UK. And a number of, not nearly all of these organisations saying that we really need to care, obviously about religious freedom in the world around us, but also about our freedom to live our lives as Christians in the UK. That would seem to be a sort of new entry in our top 10, as it were, issues for Christians today. And the other new issue is obviously Brexit. That wasn't, there was issues around should we or should we not have a Euro referendum in the last election, but now Brexit has an issue we should be thinking about Christianity. And the impacts on things like immigration and trade and issues of freedom coming up in a way that they haven't before. So do take those away, do have a read through that, do see some of the issues they've flagged up. I'm going to use that again in a moment. But then the other thing is to say is that policy is one way of working on how you vote as a Christian, but it's not the only way. Obviously, for some of us, we might think actually policy is what matters most, and that is what's going to determine. I care most about religious freedom, and I think this party cares most about religious freedom in the way that I want it to, therefore I'm going to vote for them. But others of us might say, actually, no, what matters most to me is not a policy issue, but a personality issue. I'm really interested in the EA, the Evangelical Alliance, in their sort of last box, point out that one of the really important things to look for is the character of the candidate that you're voting for. So I'm sure. You know, they say, is the person going to be a voice of the voiceless? And in integrity, they raise the issue, how do candidates propose to demonstrate integrity and grace in how they communicate in debate? One of the things it's good to do is try and work out, what is the personality of the person who's going to put my cross upon? Are they somebody that actually is not just that we're going to believe in the right policies, but behave in the right sort of way? We know that as Christians, that debate this world, what you say and what you do, key. So policy might be the way you determine how you vote. Personality might be the way that affects how you vote. And the other things you might want to think about, also convenient beginning with P, are two other things. We vote, don't we, in the UK system for our local MP, but we know that that has a knock-on effect if he's going to be Prime Minister. And you might want to put your cross by the party that actually is going to get you the Prime Minister you want. Even actually, you don't seem like the personality of the local MP. Prime Minister might be the big thing that's going to affect how you vote in this election. The other thing that might vote, which is a slightly different one, is just remembering that the other thing you're doing as you vote is you are selecting a parliament. And you might, in a seat that you live in Bristol, think, to be honest, I'm not going to have much of an effect on who the Prime Minister is because of just who's in contention in my constituency. But I do have a chance to affect who I want to sit in parliament and what vote of views I want to be in parliament. And I do have the opportunity not perhaps to vote across into government, but to make sure that the opposition parties in the Parliament are strong and can stand up for people like me. So you might vote on the basis of the policies, you might vote on the basis of personalities, you might vote on who you want to be Prime Minister, you might vote on what you want Parliament to be like. And each of those ways would be valid ways of voting from a Christian perspective. Perhaps just a slightly different thing to determine how different people in this room vote today. And the last election, I made the choice to vote for the Parliament category. I thought I would want a Parliament that's slightly more representative in the views. Therefore, I'm going to vote in a slightly different way to how I voted in the election beforehand. When I voted much more in a Prime Minister, this is the vote for Prime Minister itself. This election, what I'm going to do is, I'm not sure.
So what I want to do is run quickly through the main Bristol constituencies so that you know what the options are depending on where you live and what's realistic or not realistic. I could have done this at the end of the last section, but it doesn't matter, I'm doing it now. And then I'll look a bit at party policies as well, so looking at people and policies. If you go to Emmanuel Westbury or Emmanuel Bishops, then you're likely to live in Bristol North West, not necessarily, but that is the main constituency. Bristol North West, the current MP is Charlotte Leslie, with a substantial majority. Next candidate at the last election was Labour, coming a little bit behind. You can see a good UKIP representation. UKIP are not fielding any candidates in Bristol except Bristol South. So there will not be a UKIP candidate unless you live in Bristol South, and they've done this in order to boost the Eurosceptic Conservative vote, and that's probably going to have an effect. So you can see Liberal Democrats trading a long way behind the Bristol West. If you are thinking strategically about voting, your choice looks a bit like blue versus red. I'm not saying you shouldn't vote for any of the others, but if you want actually to get an MP in culling the vote for, that's really the race. Bristol North West is what we call a bellwether constituency. Where it goes, the country tends to go. You look at that bar chart, it looks very like the country as a whole. And it tends to vote as the country as a whole does. So if Charlotte Leslie loses her seat, Theresa May probably loses her place in Upper 10 Downing Street as well. If you live in Clifton, or pretty much anywhere from here, up north, north-central Bristol, you'll be in Bristol West. Slightly confusingly, Bristol West is the constituency for the centre of Bristol, and a bit north of the centre. And there you can see the constituency returned a Labour candidate at the last election. Greens running very close second. This is a high target seat for the Green Party. Bristol West, they're building White Scott Cater, one of their leading spokeswomen. And very hopeful they might snatch it from Labour. I'm not sure that's realistic given the polls, but they might. Liberal Democrats, of course, Stephen Williams was the candidate, was the MP in Bristol West for 10 years, lost it in 2015, he's standing again hoping to recover it. It's a bit of a three-way marginal. You could go either red or green or orange in Bristol West. I'm not sure the Conservatives stand that much of a chance of getting in this constituency. If you're over Bristol East, that's not, it's over further than Bishops, and a bit more over, probably not many people in Bristol East, but just for the sake of the record, held by Labour, Conservatives pushing away at it. It's one of the Conservative target seats. They're hoping, if they can swing it, to pick up that massive UKIP vote, which won't be fielding a candidate in Bristol East, and turn it from purple into blue and beat the Labour. So there is a real race going on in Bristol East between Labour and Conservative. Bristol South, rather more secure than the Labour Party, long held by the Labour Party, although again, note the size of that UKIP vote. You can see why Jeremy Corbyn is so keen to make sure that people who are in favour of Brexit don't think they have to vote Conservative. Because you can see, if you again put those two blocks together, even Bristol South, which has always been there, as long as anyone can remember, could fall to Conservatives. And that's what it was looking like about 3 or 4 weeks ago, perhaps not so obvious now. And finally, Felton and Bradley Stoke, going to the bottom of Gloucestershire, very, very strongly Conservative. In fact, with the current swing, it's likely that Declan Preston will return with an even bigger majority, than the size of the UK there as well. I hope that just gives you a sense of where the different constituencies lie in Bristol. Two Conservative, three Labour constituencies, and a very wide spread of variation. Now, let's move on to the question of Christian agendas. As Ed said, I'm sure this is a little bit little, but what I want to try and do with this slide is show what Ed really told us at the moment. If you look at some of these different Christian organisations, you'll see there are a number of issues which they tend to agree on matters of concern for Christians, and others on which they have slightly different emphases. And when you start to think about these different emphases, they actually make sense. I'll read them out. Right in the middle, and what I've done is I've compared three. I've compared the Anglican archbishops. So that's Justin Welby and John Centami sent a letter around a few weeks ago saying, you know, this is what you should care about. Catholic bishops always do this, they've done it for a long time. They sent a letter out saying this is what you should care about. And I compared it with the Christian Institute, because the Christian Institute produced a little booklet, which is quite a detailed analysis of party policy from the perspective of what they care about. Now, what we have in common in the middle are two issues, marriage and family, support for Christian understanding of marriage and family, and support for Christian education. Now, in the case of the Anglican archbishops, what they mean by Christian education is Church of England schools, largely. And what the Catholic bishops mean is Catholic schools, and what the Christian Institute mean is private Christian schools and the rights of Christian parents to homeschool. So you do see a slight difference in what they mean when they talk about education, but we do have that at the centre of something that all these different groups from across the Christian spectrum, Catholic, Anglican, and largely non-conformist evangelical, what they have in common is this concern for marriage and family policy and concern for education. We move outwards. Let's start over on the left with the Anglican archbishops. The Church of England is the established church, so it's no surprise to find them saying quite a lot about the public role and value of religion. They're saying it's really important that people should be allowed to be religious in public, and the secular agenda is taking over and making it harder and harder for people to admit to a religious faith. Look at what happened to Tim Fanning a few weeks ago in that ill-fated interview. And I think they're picking up on that. They don't name it, they imply that that's what they're concerned about, where politicians can't have traditional Christian views anymore because of the nature of politics. And they say that's a really, really bad thing. We have to find ways of making it okay to be religious in public. They're the established church. Over on the right-hand side, the Catholic bishops, what they are particularly concerned about, something which none of the others pick up, questions around vulnerable. So, for example, they pick up on questions of prison reform. Are we just forgetting about prisons? And they also pick up on the issue of UK migrants. Again, there's a reason for that. A lot of the migrants from the European Union who come into the UK and are working here are Catholic. The Roman Catholic Church has absorbed them, and there's a massive Catholic Polish population in the UK who are now feeling very insecure, obviously. So they have a particular concern about how we treat migrants within the UK. What the Anglicans and Catholics have in common are a whole host of things around care for the vulnerable. They talk a lot about international aid and development. They talk about issues of poverty, issues of health care, social care, and so on. So quite a big overlap. We move to the bottom of the chart and go to the Christian Institute, you find a quite different set of concerns. They have a concern, firstly, for what they call public morality, what in the 19th century would have been called the suppression of vice. This is a long-standing Puritan concern with things like gambling, prostitution, alcohol, drugs, keeping Sunday special, things like that, and they keep a watching brief on that sort of area. They also are very concerned about religious liberty in the UK, a point that, Ed mentioned a moment ago. It's interesting that the Anglicans and Catholics, both of whom represent fairly well-established traditional churches, are not so obviously worried about religious liberty yet. But certainly the Christian Institute, more independent Christians, are. Is there something that the Catholics and the Christian Institute have in common? Yes. They both care a lot about medical ethics, particularly life issues, abortion, euthanasia, things like that, embryo research, and have very similar views. Catholic and evangelicals have very similar views often on those ones. Church of England tend to be a bit less concerned about those areas. I could find nothing that the Anglican Archbishops and Christian Institute have in common. You can read into that what you will. Okay, so there we have some sense of Christian agendas, a certain amount in common, a certain amount that are spread around, and you can already begin to see there, I think, a little bit of a political division going on. You know, if you're Catholic, you're likely to care quite a lot about issues around poverty and exclusion and vulnerability. It doesn't figure on the Christian Institute's hit list. They do say that there are other issues, but that's not what they care about, not what they campaign on. If you're a Christian Institute, you care a lot about deregulation of drugs and things like that. Frankly, Church of England Catholics are not really worried about that. So, when we look at the party agendas, we have all sorts of problems. I think we've got four problems as we look at the manifestos. The first problem is, we don't know ourselves how to prioritise these different elements. I mean, you might have a sense yourself that some are more important than others, and that's great, but actually generally as Christians it's quite hard to defend a particular set of priorities. There's a need for wisdom there. What's more important? Is it more important that we increase the overseas aid budget and we spend that wisely? Or is it more important that we solve the problem of social care in the UK? It's really, really tricky. So that's our first problem. We've got these slightly different agendas and we don't know how to prioritise. The second problem we've got is that the manifestos of the five main parties, which are the ones I looked at, differ quite a lot in style. The Labour and the Liberal Democrat Party manifestos are fairly detailed, they're quite long, take a long time to read. The UKIP is a bit selective, it does certain things in a lot of detail and misses other things out. The Greens is wonderful, it's only got 10 pages of substance and they're quite large font and bullet points, you can read it in about 5 or 10 minutes. And the Conservatives is very vague and general, and not entirely wishy-washy, but it is fairly sort of mood music manifesto rather than concrete proposal. So that's another problem we've got. The manifestos are rather different. The third problem we've got is that manifestos don't contain all of the party's policies or records. They contain an offer for the next parliament. If you look at the Christian Institute's election briefing, they give you quite a detailed analysis based on the past record of the parties, on policy announcements in recent years, and actually not the manifestos, because the manifestos haven't been published when the Christian Institute drew their document up. It doesn't matter, they've actually got more detail than that. So one of the things you could do is look online at the Christian Institute if you care about the things they care about, and you'll see a lot of detail on the different parties. I'll tell you in a moment where they land. They can't tell you that, but I can tell you where they land, on which party, in a moment. So there's a problem there about knowing what the parties actually stand for. And the final problem is that most politics is about means and not ends. It's about means and not ends. It's how we do what we all agree we need to do. And the debate about social care is a classic point. So everyone agrees, all the parties, all the manifestos say we have a problem in managing social care for the elderly. And the question is, how on earth are you going to manage this and pay for it? And the bizarre thing about the debate that's gone on is that usually it's the Conservative Party that tries to defend the value of the inheritance that you might give to your children when you die, and it's usually the Labour Party that wants to tax it and take it away. And we saw the rather interesting phenomenon of the Conservative Party suggesting that you spend the value of your inheritance and the Labour Party rushing to the defence of wealthy middle-class homes. Right. So let's run through the five manifestos, and again, what I've done here is something very superficial. I've tried to capture the direction of travel of the entire manifesto, where it's heading politically, to get a sense of context. And I picked out just a few issues that Christians, regardless of where they are on the spectrum, Anglican, Catholic, Evangelical, whatever, might think are good, might cheer for, and a couple of things where they might have some questions, and might have lots. So again, this is not everything, there are lots of others, and maybe in discussion some more issues will come up. But here we go. Conservative Manifesto is really interesting. Forward together, the slogan, it's interesting because it has abandoned free market economics. So conservatism has become quite capitalist, quite free market in recent years. Theresa May apparently is not. She's what we call more of a red Tory, a centrist Tory, a one nation Tory. And there's this amazing passage at the beginning of the manifesto, and I'll just read you a bit of it. We must reject the ideological templates provided by the socialist left and the libertarian right, and instead embrace the mainstream view that recognises the good that governments can do. We do not believe in untrammeled free markets. We reject the cult of selfish individualism, and so on and so on. So there is it aligns the Conservative Party much more with Catholic social thought, which is a sort of well-recognised body of influence on what we call red Toryism. And it has a number of examples of ways in which the government want to intervene to try and solve particular problems. I'll give you some examples of that. There's quite a lot in there about employee representation on boards of companies. So this is the German model. It's not the only party to recommend this, but instead of having the capital-labour divide, you put representatives of the workforce on your board of directors to try and achieve some sort of compromise in corporate management. There's something in the Conservative Manifesto about faith schools, particularly Catholic faith schools, and the difficulties they have getting new schools established, and we want to make that possible. There's a lot, and I think this is the biggest thing that the Conservatives want to emphasise, is the need for internet regulation. So lots of worry about access to pornography, access to extremist speech, to hate speech, to bullying in social media and the internet, and the manifesto says we just have to get on top of that. We have to find ways of dealing with that, which is actually quite difficult and involves quite a high level of government intervention. But if you're, say, coming from some Christian background, you might be cheering for those green proposals. Where I think you might be worried is the language that carries on about British values. There's a sense here that we need to build an ethical community around British values. British values are very important. And when you ask what these values are, you read things that sound quite nice: freedom, democracy, tolerance, and the rule of law, and so on. But we know also that you can smuggle things into this loose values talk, which might actually be quite hostile to some Christians. So do we trust this new commitment to ideology in public? Question there. And of course, the big question always with Conservatives, the one which they were hammered in the debate last night, is the question of whether they are actually providing enough support for the vulnerable, as they claim. Theresa May claims that she wants to provide a manifesto that quotes hard-working families, but is governing in the interests of ordinary working families what it takes to deal with the poorest and most vulnerable members of society. Move next to the Labour Party. For the many, not the few, again, a leftwards shift. It's quite remarkable. Both the main parties have moved to the left politically. And of course, that's a long-running debate between Jeremy Corbyn and most of his MPs, who are not as left-wing as he is. But he clearly has set out a manifesto to return to big state socialism. And there are all sorts of things in there that we might cheer for. Banking regulation, I think, is an urgent need. The banking sector has become out of control in all sorts of ways, very dangerously so. We want to set up a national care service to match the National Health Service to deal with the social care problem. They have a child obesity strategy. And they spend quite a lot of time talking about personal prison rehabilitation plans. So once again, trying to engage in prisons and do something positive for prisoners to ensure that they can lead valuable lives on release. So, and this is just a small selection. There's a whole load of stuff in there which we might cheer for. But then there are things like the proposal that they want to change the equality legislation and the Gender Recognition Act to change the test from gender assignment to gender identity. This is about breaking the medicalization of transsexualism, so you no longer have to go through a medical process in order to be treated as a member of the other sex. You can just declare it effectively. So you can say, I consider myself to be male or female. What do we make of that? Is that good or not? And they also propose the introduction of no-fault divorce. Typically, Christians have been rather cautious about going down that route of allowing people to separate just on giving notice after a period of time. Typically, 1 year in those no-fault systems. What about the Liberal Democrats? Change Britain's future. I call them liberal throughout. They are. They're liberal in all sorts of ways. Ways which are rather good and ways which are perhaps not so good. So we can see the Liberal Democrats, they want to get on top of the issue of arms exports to try and deal with the funding of oppressive regimes. They're very internationalist in scope. We know that's part of their anti-Brexit stand, is that they're open to the outside world. They want to set up a global education strategy for working out how to ensure that every child receives minimal basic education across the whole world. They want an ambassador-level champion of freedom of religion. Remember, we were talking a moment ago about this being one of the emerging issues for Christians. Well, the Liberal Democrats do believe in liberty. They do believe in freedom of religion or belief, and so they want to champion it worldwide, and we hope in the UK as well. But liberty, as I said, cuts both ways. They also talk about providing more choice at the end of life. Now, in the manifesto, that seems to refer to the provision of hospice care. Fantastic, we say, that's great. More provision of hospice care than those who are terminally ill. But you look at that phrase of more choice in end-of-life decisions and you ask yourself, do they mean euthanasia as well? Is that the sort of choice of being liberals they probably do? And then, quite notably, this has been through the news, they want to decriminalise the sale and purchase of cannabis. They think it would be much better to regulate things by having a much cheaper regulated supply. And also prostitution, sex work, generally deregulated. So we see, classically with the Liberal Democrats, liberty cutting both ways. Well, UKIP. UKIP, of course, are trying to reinvent themselves, having won one big argument, they now need to find another argument. And I think what Paul Nuttall is trying to do is to cast themselves as a party that defends the national but not the global interest. To the sense of really putting the UK first and not worrying about the rest of the world. There are some interesting ideas in there. There's an interesting thing about house building. We do face a housing problem in this country, and it's quite a worked out plan for how you can generate large quantities of low cost, good quality housing that you could look at. Quite a lot of thoughtful work done around fisheries and coastal town regeneration. Coastal towns suffering economically quite badly in many parts of England and Wales, and again, some very detailed material in the manifesto on that. They also, interestingly, are quite puritanical, if I can put it like that. They want to restrict the sale of alcohol because it hurts people and damages people. Interesting to find a party actually proposing that. But, as I said, putting Britain first, global, not the global, natural interest, they want to reduce the aid budget radically. Cut the aid budget on the grounds that it goes to dodgy regimes like Pakistan. We don't want that. So they cut it from 0.7 to 0.2%, and that allows them to fund the NHS. They want to repeal the Climate Change Act 2008. Hello, Donald Trump, we're your friends. And they want to do things like ban the niqab and burqa, Islamic headdress, in public, and ban Sharia courts, and ban Jewish Islamic ways of slaughter, and basically ban religious practices that are not British, I'm Christian. Now, interestingly, I'm being a bit cynical here. As I said, UKIP are not dealing with any candidates except in Bristol South, so if you'd like this, you can't vote for them, bad luck. On the analysis of Christian Institute, UKIP came out way top on terms of their historic record in what they vote for. So the sort of things that Christian Institute are saying we as Christians should worry about, the rank order goes UKIP way up the top, then Conservatives just about positive, more good than bad. Then you're down to Labour, Liberal Democrats, and at the very bottom of the pile of Greens. So you might want to go and have a look at that document. They can't tell you that because they're a charity. Charities are not allowed to campaign politically. But if you read their analysis of the policies, it becomes clear. And finally, we get to the Greens. A confidence of caring Britain. What have we characterised Green Party policy? I think we can say the Greens care about pursuing equality radically, really radically, really seriously, taking the command for equality. Of course, equality is a great Christian value as well, written deeply throughout the whole Bible. And we see some very practical ways to try and get there. They're talking about introducing a universal basic income. So one of the more radical ideas is a guaranteed minimum income, whatever you do, whatever you work at. Of course, the Environmental Protection Act is a key element of their policy. And they're the only party who actually wants to increase overseas aid to 1% of GDP. However, as you read their manifesto, you do wonder, they want to quote, they want to bring academies and preschools under local authority control. Academies and preschools are often set up by trusts run by Christian organisations, and so you begin to think, hang on, this is looking like the state taking over from civil society, Christian groups who want to run education. I'm not sure that the Catholic bishops or judges are very happy with that. And then there's this curious phrase, what they want is, quotes, real equality, this is just a quotation, real equality for LGBTIQA plus people, if you don't know what any of those letters mean, you can ask afterwards, sexual minorities, and we might ask ourselves, what's real equality? Clearly they think they haven't got it yet. Does that mean basically that if you have views which suggest that some of the practices associated with some of those letters are unethical or immoral, you are denying real equality? Well, they probably do mean that, being the Green Party. So there might be a set of concerns about where that is taking us in terms of the direction of travel and public policy. That is all I wanted to say, and then very superficially giving you a bit of sense of the five political parties, where they're coming from, the sorts of things Christians might cheer for, and the sorts of things that we might be concerned about as we look at their policies. As Ed said, one of the big issues, of course, is Brexit, and now I'm going to hand over to Katie to talk us through some of the issues relating to that.
Yes, so Brexit obviously is a key issue in this election debate. But interestingly, it's been very much sidelined in the election debate, if you've noticed that. It goes without saying that the party that we elect will be the party to decide on how we leave the European Union, the implications of that, and both national and international implications. Amongst other things, what this election does is provides us with the opportunity to contemplate what each party considers to be the aims of and priorities for the EU. So let's get started. One thing to mention before we do have a look at what the different aims are, is it's worth noting that looking back at what parties have voted for in the past and their stance on different issues is actually quite a good indicator of how they might go forward. Obviously bearing in mind everything that Julian has just said, the way that the parties are changing. The reason is, when we consider Brexit issues, there's a general perception that actually what the EU does is it just passes down law to us, we just have to follow it, and that's it, we don't get a say. That's not actually true for a whole list of different reasons which we don't have the time to go into tonight. What I would say is, if you just consider something like immigration, the EU obviously has a main role to play in how we deal with EU migrants into the country and how we can leave the country within the European Union borders. But what it doesn't have a say on is European is immigration worldwide, and it doesn't have a say on what we do necessarily with immigrants to this country going forward. So all the different parties will be considering all of those things as a whole and not just EU needs immigration, free movement of people. It's not quite simple, so just bear that in mind. Let's start with Conservatives. The Conservatives quote, Brexit means Brexit. You've probably heard Theresa May say that a number of times. She has quite an interesting way of actually just saying the same thing to every question, sometimes as a politician does, which just always makes us chuckle in our mouth. What she really wants to do is work very closely with the EU to forge a new special relationship with them. How will she deal with the European Union law that is currently divorced in the UK? Well, they want to pass a great repeal bill which just makes all the EU law to date into UK law and then sorts out the implications of that afterwards. So some of it will stay, some of it will go, and some of it will see in a different way. What does walking closely with the So, across Federation, she wants to end the free movement of people within the EU borders and establish a new policy. And her new policy will aim to control immigration to get the numbers down to tens of thousands. So, there's a numbers issue there for them. And that's EU numbers and non EU numbers. They want to control immigration broadly across throughout the world. For trade, very focused on leaving the single market and the customs union. But again, she wants to form this deep and special partnership, which for her includes negotiating comprehensive free trade and customs agreements and championing free trade globally. Of course, what we're talking about when we talk about negotiations is very much what they want to go to the table with, but that has no indication of what we'll actually come out with, so do just bear that in mind. Just because that's what they're targeting doesn't mean that's what we'll get, and that's across all parties. And for the environment and for workers' rights, it's a sort of yes and no, we're not quite sure. And the reason we're not quite sure is because the manifesto is very clear that initially we will just keep all the European environment and workers' rights legislation that's been passed throughout our membership time. But then it's actually very silent on what they'll do with it afterwards. So I mentioned at first they'll keep it and then they'll start working it out. The manifestos don't really mention what they would do with European workers' rights, whether they'll keep them, whether they'll get rid of them, how they'll change them. And it's a bit more information on environment. They want to maintain the current standards, is really what they say, and be a world leader in environment. As Julian said, a little bit verbose, the Conservative Manifesto doesn't really give us anything concrete, so that's as much as I can give you for them. Just a quick moment on refugees, because I know that's quite a key issue to some people. The only pledge in the Conservative Manifesto for refugees is that wherever possible they'll offer asylum, and they'll continue to work with Europe and the European Union on that issue. Labour. Labour also has stated that if it accepts the referendum result, we will exit the EU under Labour. And their priority in exiting the EU is to, they quote, put the national interest first, and that means the priorities in our trade negotiations will be favouring growth, jobs and prosperity. How they want to exit will be a collaborative approach. They strongly feel that leaving the EU with no deal would be the worst possible scenario for us, and it would significantly damage our trade and our economy, so they will reject that as a viable option and they will negotiate until they get something which is a deal. What does that mean in terms of these key issues? For immigration, they've moved away from the numbers-based immigration target. There's no target in their manifesto. Instead, the decisions on immigration were based on growth, jobs and prosperity, their key aims. They do specifically state that they want to make certain reforms to the immigration policy currently, worldwide immigration policy, but not the EU immigration policy, which the EU members will be brought under the worldwide policy, if that makes any sense, sorry. And some of these issues will be around differentiating between migrant labour and family attachments and replacing income thresholds for immigration, things like that. Specifically, what they want to do is, in the long term, develop new immigration rules encompassing all immigrants to the UK, which they want to be informed by both the European Union and other partners, including Commonwealth nations. On refugees, on the immigration point, Labour strongly state that they don't see refugees as migrants. They're those people who have been forced out of their homes by war or famine, etc. They have a strong pledge to overhaul the current arrangements for housing of refugees, which they don't see as fit for purpose. They say that they're not fair, and they want to review the arrangements. What they'll actually do with that, we're not quite sure from the manifesto. On trade, they don't want to be part of the common market anymore. It's very much a leave the EU, but they do want to ensure that the EU continues to be a priority trading partner, and they want to retain unrestricted access to UK goods and services. Again, how realistic that is going to the negotiating table, we're not sure, remains to be seen. They want to also work globally to develop free trade and investment agreements to remove trade jobs and high standards. Again, what that practically means, I'm not sure. Environment and workers' rights, they very much want to maintain the status of the current EU legislation in our legislation currently. For environment, they see the EU as a very positive impact and they want to continue to work with the EU on that going forward. And for workers' rights, they recognise that the EU has played a key role in workplace and workers' protection. They want to retain all beneficial EU derived workplace laws. We're not quite sure what they mean by beneficial, what they see as good and what they see as bad. Ensure there's a pledge to ensure that they don't lag behind EU standards going forward. What will happen with Labour when the discussions come to an end? Well, they pledge that they're going to legislate to ensure that Parliament, once the deal is on the table, have a meaningful vote on the final Brexit deal. Much more spoken then, Lib Dem priority is to keep Britain as close as possible to Europe. Lib Dem is very much a we stay within the European Union pledge as far as they can. Immigration, they want continued support for freedom of movement. They do pledge a greater focus on infrastructure to ensure that the UK infrastructure can deal with the levels of migration that we see. For refugees, they're very clear that they want to expand the Syrian vulnerable persons resettlement scheme to over 50,000 in the next parliament, including 3,000 unaccompanied young children. They're the only party that make a pledge specifically in relation to Syrian refugees in the manifesto. Trade, they will continue membership of both the customs market and the customs union and retain all rights in the EU financial markets. Of which they see London as the EU financial capital. Environment, again, maintain current EU standards, continue with the closest possible cooperation on EU climate change and energy policy, workers' rights, their pledges to retain the current EU workers' rights in the UK. What will they do? If they negotiate a deal for us, once it comes on the table, they're offering a referendum on the final Brexit deal with the option to stay within the EU on that paper. Yeah. Unsurprisingly, no compromise Brexit. They don't really agree with the European Union as immigration. They don't want to be bound by any freedom of movement obligations. They want to halve the net migration to the UK for 5 years and introduce over that time an Australian style point system with an additional seasonal work scheme to alleviate the seasonal work crisis that we face. Refugees, they want to honour the obligations to bona fide asylum seekers without really any reference as to what that means. Trade, exit single markets and customs union, they say they want all rights to set tariff barriers, prioritise free trade agreements, and come to the World Trade Organisation to party in our own right. Environment, they want very much to move more towards a homegrown environmental policy. To repeal some of the EU environment directives which they consider to have done damage to the UK and introduce a new Environmental Protection Act. Workers' rights, they do want to protect workers' rights on leaving the EU, but there's little specific detail about what that would mean and what they mean. Greens, they again want continued membership of the European Union. For immigration, they want to protect freedom of movement. They want a pledge of immediate guarantee of the right of EU citizens to stay within the UK and reciprocal relationships abroad, which I think I may want to mention that Labour pledge on that as well, without freedom of movement piece. For refugees, they want the asylum system taking responsibility for the flow of migrants worldwide, and not specifically focused on on Syrian refugees. But they do want to up the level of responsibility they have worldwide. For trade, simply, they want to remain in the single market. For environment, they want to safeguard EU rights, workers' rights, and safeguard EU rights. Very simple. As Julian said, if you want to feel virtuous that you've read an entire manifesto, you need the way forward. And at the end of the day, they will offer a referendum on the detail of whatever deal is negotiated. So that's it. Sorry, you very much have stopped all the other questions. Please do ask them to me at the end, if they have time just now. And do email questions for yourself.
So a lot of policies, and you might be thinking, well, for me, actually, personality matters a little bit more. I want to know who I'm sending as my representative. Particularly bearing in mind that we're probably aware that there are, for instance, a lot of Labour candidates who aren't particularly fans of Jeremy Corbyn. And so, is it, well, we might vote thinking Jeremy Corbyn's the best thing that's ever happened to the UK, and we should find out that the person we voted for does not agree with us on that one, even though there's an underlying ballot. Or we might find that we're voting for somebody who we're actually really attracted by. This view sort of taking Theresa May's sort of taking this, you know, into sort of ideology in the Conservative Party, but actually find out that our local candidate is a Thatcherite ideologue. And therefore, actually, what we voted for is not what we're getting. And so, one of the things it's probably helpful for us to do, one of the things we might want to do, is actually get to know the candidates themselves and find out what they think and what they're like. Now, the dream way of doing this is actually meeting the candidates. And some of us might have already had opportunities to do that out and about in Bristol. They might have come to our calls and canvassed us, and that's perhaps given us a bit of an impression as to what they're like. Others of us perhaps have been around Bristol for a while and know what the reputation of the local MP is. Know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who's pretty good friends with the Green candidates. And sometimes that can really help us to pick up what they're like. Find actually what they care about, who they are. If though you haven't had that personal conversation, and if you haven't got a friend of a friend of a friend, how do you find out about the candidates? Well, hustings have been taking place, a few hustings perhaps still about to take place. But of course, the other great thing is the internet. You can find a lot about the positions on the internet. And I just want to take you through a few of the websites you can go to find out some really helpful stuff about a candidate across two of the constituencies in Bristol. That's going to require me using technology, and there's a great irony in instructing anybody else on the internet to get all of that to the press. That's been already embraced. No, there we are, brilliant, okay. What website you can go to? This is the wonderfully named Election 2017 website. It's actually done by Christian Concern, but they clearly bought the website quite early on in the project. And they have got each constituency, this sort of page, which is really helpful. And it basically takes you through the candidates that you've got and gives you a lot of information on them. So this is Bristol West. And you've got the 2017 candidates, you've got really helpful links under each of the headings. You can, you know, find out, you've got their web, you've got their email address, you've got their Twitter address, you've got their website, you've got their Facebook page. And then also, you have got, under those who have served in Parliament, you've got helpful information on some of the things that they have done. So, when we come to, we've got a view on some of the things that Christian Concern care about. So they care about parental resistance to suicide, Sunday trading, decriminalisation of abortion, and they have got what they think the issues absent of resistance to suicide bill. Basically, she did a good vote on Sunday trading and a bad vote on decriminalisation of abortion. You can find out more about those things, but you get a sense of their track record. Obviously, that's easier to do than people who've actually sat in Parliament. Molly Scott Cato hasn't got a photo, and actually hasn't got a record. She hasn't served as an MP, she's just an MP. Same for the Monkey Free Party and for the Money Free Party. Slightly unfortunate. Conservative candidate, but Stephen Williams was an MP, and you'll see that Christian Concern have quite an interesting photo. Might or might not affect what you vote for. It's just all these sort of sites are going to need a bit of processing because they reflect the view of the organisation to put them together. But it is a way of finding out about it. And that's one example. A slightly more reliable way of doing things would be going to this website, which is Hansard. Hansard is the record of what happens in Parliament, what debates are taking place. And if you are thinking about or wanting to get to know somebody who has served an MP, you can go to that website and you can enter their name and you can find out very conveniently what debates they have taken part in, what questions they have asked. And it's a good way of finding out what somebody cares about. So this shortlist, I think, is the, or is until recently, the MP for Bristol North West, and the candidate again. And you can see what she has been doing in Parliament. She's been taking part in the debate on the neighbourhood planning bill. And if you really care about neighbourhood planning, that might affect your vote. As you go through her information, you find out what her interests are. She takes part in a lot of debates on the NHS and foreign policy in particular. And you can find out by clicking these things what she thinks of these things. You can get to know her through what she said in Parliament. So if you really want to track somebody's record in Parliament, somebody who's already served, go to the Hansard website, look up and find out what they care about, find out what they can say, find out how they've been representing MPs. Some of the candidates though actually have stood as MPs, so you can't go and find out their speeches, but of course you can with great joy go to Twitter. And you know, it's part and parcel of the system now that they've all got to that Twitter account. And again, you find out things about them through their Twitter account. Often, actually, the further you go back on their Twitter account, you find out more and more. Because you find out about their personal life beforehand when they're slightly less guarded and they, you know, represent themselves perhaps slightly more accurately than they are today. But, you know, there's a lot to be found out from somebody's sort of Twitter account. Darren Jones is a lot of responding to people who send their voting for him, but also other stuff as well. And again, it's also interesting to note how often the candidate actually retweeting things from central headquarters. You'll find some of them are doing it a lot because actually they agree with what's coming out of central headquarters. Some of them aren't doing it quite so much because they agree less with what's happening at central headquarters. The final thing you can do is obviously the sort of the classic Google search. And when it comes to Scott Cater, who's standing for the Greens in Bristol West, you find out she's written a lot. If you want to get to know her, you can find out a lot by reading a whole series of articles that she's written for the Guardian newspaper at the time. So actually, you know, it turns out in fact, sorry, it wasn't Bristol. But you know, there's a lot of information there on the internet about her. I know it's sort of pretty basic, but in some ways just going onto the internet and using those tools can help you find out quite a lot about the particular candidate in your research agency. So, you know, go to those websites, use those websites so that you can get to know your candidate a little bit better. Another couple of websites have got just a lot of the handouts are sort of there for fun, but also can help you. So there's two websites there. There's the Vote for Policies website. That is a website you can go to, and it will ask you what issues you care about, and then it will give you basically the section from each of the party manifestos, and it will get you to choose which most represents your view. And by the end of the process, it will tell you who you should be voting for based on which policies you like best. One of the helpful things about it is that it doesn't tell you which party it is. You can often guess, particularly because you've had a good briefing this evening, but at the end of it, it will tell you who you should vote for. I will tell you, you know, it's all about who I should vote for. But the other thing to go to is the Political Compass website, which is a slightly different one. And it asks, I think, slightly more sophisticated questions, and not based on policy as from the party manifestos, but just based on sort of bigger questions. And that will also then tell you where you sit on both a right-left spectrum, or an authoritarian-libertarian spectrum. And again, it will tell you which of the parties in the UK you are closer to. The problem is, the more of these surveys that you do, the more confused you will get. So I did Vote for Policies yesterday, and I was being told I should be voting for UKIP, which like shocked me. I then did Political Compass and found out that the politician from world history that most agreed with me was Gandhi, and I should be voting Labour. So, how do we account for that? Well, one of the things we need to realise is Christians is that we will confound a lot more of these surveys, because as Christians, hopefully, our thinking is quite different to all around us. And actually, a lot of our views don't fit very neatly into some of the boxes that other people have put into. And that therefore, as a result, we should perhaps expect when we go to someone on some of the online surveys that they can't quite cope with us. But if we care about a range and a mixture of issues, that doesn't really make sense to a human algorithm, but it does make sense, hopefully. Or at least that's how I managed to resolve the crisis. That's, I think, all we've got to say, really. As ever, if you came wanting to know how to vote, you would be disappointed, since we're not going to tell you, unlike some churches perhaps in the US. But we hope that to be helpful, as we're giving you information and giving you places to go for find out more information. Now really is time for questions and comments. If you want to sort of, I think in the sort of slides where people can just sort of speak from where they are, and if you want to sort of shout out a question or comment, that would be great, and we will do our best to respond. So any questions or comments, just go for it. Start. Who's going to kick us off? Joshua, thank you.
Is it at all worth voting for someone we like best if we think they won't win?
Everybody hear the question? But for somebody we like that, even if we don't think they will win, is that worth it?
One thing to say is, yes, of course we can say that some candidates we can be virtually certain that they won't win, but others we don't know that. And that's why it's worth looking at the voting in the previous election to see which candidates are really running and which ones are not. I think the other thing you have to bear in mind is that parties are conscious they have to attract the majority vote. So if they see a lot of people voting for a particular other party, it does have an impact on them, it has an indirect impact on them. So if lots of people in the UK started voting Green, it might make no difference to the number of Green MPs in the House of Commons, but it would almost certainly make a difference to the parties who are not getting seats because their voters are being attracted away by the Greens. So there is a sense in which it has this indirect effect. This is the UKIP problem. UKIP only managed to put one MP in 2015, and yet the size of the UKIP vote has had the effect of skewing the Conservative and Labour Party policies, who are generally pro-Europe and whether they might vote Brexit. So you can do it. It takes a lot of people to do it. You personally can't do it. That's inevitable in democracy. But I think it is worth doing for that sort of a reason, as a sort of long-term strategy.
I think the other thing I'd add is that although we're voting Labour, the total across the country of people who voted for Labour and Conservative is added up. It does have some effect on the political power of the party. But the party knows that they want the popular vote across the country and they've got more of a percentage vote across the country. That does affect things politically. So you might look at some of those things and think, well, if there's no point voting in this constituency, it will have an effect. It will have an effect on the national thing, both in ways, as Jeannie said, but also in the sense of we do add together all the Green Party votes and people notice the percentage is going up and down.
It could also make a difference next time, so if there's a bigger Green contingent this time, that might then mobilise more people to vote Green next time, so just because they won't get it this time doesn't mean that they won't in the next election.
Yeah, and most seats change in party hands, but what happens is there's some people that, if you look at some of the smaller parties, how they eventually won seats, because just in a series of 5 or 6 elections, they slowly should.
Interestingly, in a Paxman interview, Jeremy Corbyn seems to have got behind the party's manifesto and they seem to be much more unified than they've ever been before. Is that something we can rely on? If Corbyn did become Prime Minister, would he actually have the backing of the Labour Party and its policies? Any inside knowledge?
Can we hear the question? And, sorry? So basically, you know, can can we expect Jeremy Corbyn to stick to his party's policies? Can we expect, I suppose, another Jeremy Corbyn's party to stick to him? I mean, we're going to work both ways on this. Who knows? It's really interesting. I mean, again, this is perhaps a slightly uncomfortable parallel, but bear with me. In the States at the moment, you've got the Republican Party, in theory, led by Donald Trump, but there's a massive gulf between where they are and where he is, and there's a certain amount of chaos as a result. That could be how I did it here, have Jeremy Corbyn run as the and a Labour Party that is more behind him. The example, just to show the conclusion, is that, you know, under the John, you know, the John Major government in 1990, there was a similar sort of issue of a sort of gap to leadership of the party as a whole in Parliament. So there are big questions to be asked about, aren't there? But you know, Theresa May is also going to have problems in the sense of that, you know, because she's a bit of a red Tory, nor her MPs are very happy with her agenda, particularly there's been on the Conservative Home website, which is the sort of the internet home of the Conservative core, there's been a lot of arguments about this rejection of patriotism. So there's always something, you know, you vote for the party leader, but there are good questions also about actually their effectiveness and ability to actually carry that party with them. And anybody's a guess whether they're not going to start Jeremy Corbyn or indeed Theresa May or indeed any of the others. Who knows?
In order that God willing, we can continue to maintain a healthy democracy in Britain, isn't it important to have an effective opposition and therefore pursue any point in order to further that in capital voting?
So should we help with the effective opposition by indeed some capital voting? Yeah, because opposition is good for government. I think, certainly the last election, I voted on the lines of it would be good to have, I was, my vote in the end was determined by wanting a range of different voices in Parliament. So actually, I didn't vote on who I wanted to be in government. I voted that on the basis, actually, there were some perspectives, some politics that were not being articulated enough in Parliament. So I voted, in essence, tactically in that way to make sure that there was a high degree of representation, particularly on the GDP House of Commons. I voted strictly unsuccessful in achieving that. But that's what I was trying to do. But you know, that is the case. One of the problems, if we think like that, is that the UK political system doesn't help us because it's first past the post.
I think Theresa May called the election because of difficulties within the Conservative Party, just as the Brexit vote was called because of difficulties within the Conservative Party. So she was having difficulty with her backbench MPs who were holding her to ransom. When you've got a majority of 17, it doesn't take many MPs to say, well, I'm going to vote with you unless, ... to have sort of have that blocking effect, which meant that she was very boxed in. I have to think that's quite good, because it means you have to move towards a very high degree of consensus politics. If Theresa May had a majority of 200, she could do what she liked. Care about it, the majority of Conservative MPs, it wouldn't matter, you could ignore them. So the challenge for us is, how do we get the right level of majority? Either way, you don't want any enemy, either political party to have a big majority. It's just really, really hard to know how we can achieve that other than by voting as best we can in particular constituency and hoping it turns out okay.
Actually, if you are considering tactical voting, there are lots of things that are on the internet about how you might go about doing that. Just want to use it as well as in practice.
Yeah, and in particular, not thinking, so the websites are like the electoral calculus website, which will give you a better idea of what's been happening in the constituency since the last election. Because you might think, oh, this party are in second place in constituency. Actually, that may not be the case now. Because, for instance, of the collapse of UKIP, or because UKIP lost standing, or because different other parties are going up and down. The electoral calculus website will help you in any constituency to show you the likely sort of, but as much as anybody can, the likely sort of intended this time around.
And just to cut to the chase on that one, the electoral calculus website predicts no change in any Bristol constituency. So the likely, they think that the guy who runs it thinks the most likely outcome is you get the same end that you currently got.
Let's go from that.
So you just said about Bristol. How does Bristol fit within the country as a whole? For most of Brexit, Bristol makes it very different to the other half of the country. So, there's a sense we can know what happened in Bristol, but not before.
Yes, how does Bristol versus the rest of the country, how does it work? That's how we know.
So, the electoral calculus website analyses every single constituency, so if you really want to have a look, you can. To take an example, Caroline Lucas, the head of the Green Party, is MP of Brighton West and has quite a substantial vote. And again, the calculus is predicting she'll retain her seat. That's the most likely outcome. What we're seeing is Conservatives pushing the SNP, so the SNP vote is likely to drop a bit in Scotland and be replaced perhaps by a new Conservative MPs, although again Labour is happy that he was there most recently. We'll see a number of seats where the Labour in a narrow majority at the moment, where the abandonment of the UKIP vote might push the Conservatives in. But again, all that analysis can be looked at on a constituency-by-constituency basis. Where Martin Baxter runs the website lands is that overall, looking at totting it all up, he thinks there'll be a majority at the moment of about 80. Current majority is work majority of 10. Majority 17, going up to 80. So he thinks there'll be some gains from the SNP, some gains from Labour, and actually that the Liberal Democrats will lose seats. He's predicting that they'll lose their current 80 down to 4 because of the impact of the Brexit. So one of the interesting things is Tim Farron, who was hoping to hoover up a lot of angry Remainers, and it doesn't seem to be working, which is interesting.
This is the wonderful electoral calculus website, which is one of my favourite websites at the moment. And you know, that's the latest prediction. It's dropped, so it's dropping all the time, the Conservative majority prediction. And it's really interesting to see what's happening. And then the other, I mean, you're all fascinated by this, aren't you? The other place to go is this. But this is 3 months later. If you want to see their prediction, this is him. They go through the Labour seats. These are all the seats that aren't going to change hands. And as you can see, there's quite a lot of them. And then suddenly, you start to get, well, actually not quite suddenly, but you begin to get seats that are changing. Liberal getting Labour, Nationalist staying, and then you come eventually. They're interesting, eh? So the Gower, a seat going from Conservative to Labour, which is reflecting the changes in the polls at the moment. And then, so finally, by about seat 214, a Cadbury, which was just won by the Conservatives in a by election, and you see the seats they expected to go from Labour to Conservative. And those are the battleground seats that will be featuring in the Great Trigonometer on the 9th of summer.
It's partly reflecting my ignorance of government, but how accountable are the parties to sticking to their manifestos? And if they're not accountable, surely looking at policy is not a very good way of voting.
Yes, so how can our parties stick to their manifestos? Is the danger of being so focused on policies that actually they vary quite a bit anyway? So, yeah, that's that.
Again, there are websites, you can have a look at this, that track party records, and you may be surprised to hear how good they are. I forget what the figure is, something 80-85% or something implemented. So we might be really suspicious, but actually parties do tend to do more or less what they say they need to do. And that's partly inertia and partly the sheer volume of stuff in politics. Once as a party you agree that something's a policy machine and it comes on, you mostly get there. Surprisingly, perhaps.
And two other factors, the civil service use the manifestos, for their briefing the ministers when they come in. And then also, within the British Constitution, there's this odd thing that the House of Lords has a convention where if it's in the party's manifesto, they're much more reluctant to oppose it. So actually, that's why getting things in the manifesto is such a significant thing, because the House of Lords then tends not to vote it down because it's a manifesto convention. It's one of these, in our wonderful unwritten constitution, it's one of these conventions that's there, it's in a manifesto, the House of Lords can't oppose it because the people have spoken. The Salisbury Convention, you know, although, we could come to it, it's amazing, so none of us have read the manifesto, but we voted for them, and therefore it has to happen. It's slightly worrying, isn't it?
Notably, the manifesto for the parties which are really likely to be in Parliament are much lighter touch than the ones who are being more idealistic. So if you mean the Green Manifesto or the Lib Dem Manifesto, they don't think against Parliament, it's very much about concrete ideas, which is why you see that there. Whereas when we spoke about the Conservative Manifesto, it's much, much softer, not really much commitment. Labour, a little bit more, but not so much. And that's why you see quite a big difference.
Okay, Josh.
You gave us another two ways of voting. So voting for policy, voting for personality, voting for prime minister, the local candidate, or political party. Historically, how do you vote across the nation? Do we tend to vote for policy? Do we tend to vote for prime minister? Are we American?
Yeah, historically, how do you know what tends to happen most? Julian says, do we know that? We don't know that. In the literature, there is there has been increasing worry that we're moving more towards a presidential system. You know, and that was, and it's been an accusation thrown at most prime ministers over the last 30 years that things are becoming more presidential. And noticeably in this campaign, the Tory party's campaign started being very controversial. You know, it was Theresa May, Conservatives. Interesting, towards the end, I noticed somebody said, towards the end of the campaign, it's now Theresa May and the Conservatives. it is interesting how it goes, but I think the suspicion is that we're more presidential, people are voting for a prime minister. But that's not always the case, and there are a lot of MPs that have a high personal vote. Because actually they're dearly loved in their constituency. And policies do affect things. And in some ways, the whole social chapter thing, or the social chapter, the social care thing in this election might show that actually policies matter much more than many people do.
It's really significant that Jeremy Corbyn decided yesterday morning to go on that election TV debate because he has been, as we're testing his impact. As he's coming across better and better and better, so his advisors can push this. You know, they're beginning to trust his personality. But it's quite clear that they didn't trust his personality at all. He wouldn't be allowed to do it. So I think there's a closing that's inevitable. But I don't know how we can stop that. It's partly a TV thing, I suspect.
Theresa May, supposedly during the EU referendum, was a Remainer. Why is she taking or proposing such a hard line in the Brexit negotiations when she was a Remainer?
Okay, so Theresa May was a Remainer, but she's taking quite a hard line in Brexit negotiations. Why is that the case? It's interesting, there's two different principles of battle. Why did Theresa May call an election? There's two different arguments around. Some people are saying, well, within the Conservative Party, she had a really tight majority which wasn't allowing her to be as hardline as she wanted to be. Or, I'm slightly more persuaded by this, that actually getting an increased majority from a Theresa May's point of view would allow her to be less hardline about Brexit than she wants to be. Because actually she won't be, as it were, under pressure from Eurosceptic right-wing MPs in the Tory Party. She'll have a little bit more flexibility.
So she's not really super hard line, she's...
Well, there is a suspicion out there, it's obviously just a personal view, that she's not, that in some ways this is buying her a little bit more flexibility. Putting her less in the hands of the Tory right-wingers. Yet, at the same time, during the campaign itself, She wants to stay in child line because she wants to get the UKIP votes back in the Tory vote. Yeah. So, you know, pity politicians are one of them who are trying to do so much at the same time and, you know, realise how, yeah, this evening had already illustrated how complicated it all is.
I think we have to take seriously the dynamics of negotiation in Brussels. That this is why she doesn't want to make a commitment to EU migrants who are here currently. Probably she does want to do that. But if she says going in, right, no problem, they can stay, she's immediately thrown away by a bargaining chip. So we've got to get beyond the impression, which is I am not going to throw any bargaining chips away whatsoever. That doesn't mean hard Brexit. It means I'm not throwing away any of my bargaining chips so that I can get what I want. And it's really hard, I think, to decode exactly where she stands. The problem is most politicians didn't want Brexit, but they've had a vote which they think they have to respect and honour. And that's very difficult. It's a really, really hard case. If you think something is wrong, if you think the majority of the population have got something wrong, do you just then walk away? In this circumstance, what would that achieve? That's really hard as well. So I think they're in a very difficult situation, and I think she's just being prudent and not giving anyone away. There's not going to be the meat as hard, particularly.
Okay. Tim, this probably should be the final question.
The specific issue of social care costs, I'd love to hear this on how a Christian should think about inheritance.
Okay, how should Christian think about inheritance in the light of all the debate about social care costs of GDP?
So, one of the things the parties don't want to talk about is the way in which the state is dependent upon the family. And there was something interesting on the BBC website today about not talking about the problem of loneliness. Why the parties are not talking about the problem of loneliness on elderly people is you can't solve it as a state. You need the family. And underneath this whole social care thing is this problem that we are running into a society which is so dysfunctional in many ways, and there are so many separate individual people that the state can no longer afford to pick up the tab. We need the family. And that's kind of something, it's an unspoken issue, and I think as Christians, we've got a role to say families are really great and they're really important, and you have to make provision for when they don't work and they're not there. But we do also need strong families. Well, I actually think the Conservative proposal was right. It's difficult to do because you're talking about releasing equity in property before the property is sold. That's speculative. Who lends the money? How do you secure it against the inheritors? But the question that the Conservative Party are facing is either it's paid for by people who are asset rich when they need their social care, or it's paid for by everybody else through general taxation, which is the more just solution. And if you say that it's paid for by the people who need it if they've got the assets, the equity tied up in their home, you also give the family the chance to jump in and help. So you can say effectively, if you want the inheritance, you look after mum and dad. Yeah? And if you don't want to do that, you have to be prepared to accept that your inheritance is going to drop. I can't see that that's wrong, because in a sense it reinforces family obligation, and I think that's right.
That's a great
idea. Yeah, it's just a really interesting, again, it's one of these really interesting physical calculations. So I think there was a degree of wanting to put things in the manifesto so that they had the political will and authority to make some radical changes that everybody knows need to be made. I suspect what they thought was, you know, if you're thinking from Tory Central Office, they're thinking, well, the elderly vote, we've got them anyway, they've got nowhere else to go. And the polls have massively responded in a negative fashion, but we'll only know next Thursday whether they made the right calculation that actually these people who are very upset and the polls have changed, actually, where else can they go? These are the sort of really interesting things they've all been thinking about. So, last comment to Katie.
When it comes to inheritance tax, it's worth noting that it's a very, very small percentage of what the government actually gets, which is why there's this gap with social care. It tends to be that many people don't reach the cap for inheritance tax. Those who vastly exceed it manage to squirrel the money away in different ways so inheritance tax doesn't get paid. So it's only a very small percentage of middlemen who would ever actually pay inheritance tax, which is why there's this gap in this gulf. So it's worth considering that as well, that it's not necessarily just taking money, it's actually that a lot of money isn't being paid at the moment where it probably could be paid otherwise.
There we are. I hope you're all as excited as I am. I hope you've got a good party plan for next Thursday evening. You've worked it all out. You know which websites you're going to have up. I have a bank of computers in front of me. Screens. I get to spend time with our friend, the gym warden. It's going to be a great night. I suspect you've got some plans. Shall I break this? Father God, you send your word that when we build the ladders that we should tend to you and ask you for wisdom, that you provide. And we invite you to provide us with the wisdom we need to take on board the things we've been talking about tonight and to vote in a way that is wise, that is godly, that brings.